McCain's emerging sense of optimism would have been even more guarded than it was. But being all in on New Hampshire? That wasn't too bad. Man, he loved that place. And why not? New Hampshire had given McCain his 19-point win over Bush in 2000, the greatest political victory of his life. More important, it was the perfect place for the kind of campaign that he had to run now. It was small, intimate, pure retail, and everybody already knew him. McCain was flat broke, after all. He had no staff. He had no pollsters. All of it was gone. Instead of the Cadillac campaign that his advisors once had in mind, he was driving around in the political equivalent of a Ford Pinto, with a hamster wheel for an engine and Rick Davis sprinting furiously on the thing to keep it spinning. And weird as it might sound, McCain preferred it this way. Living off the land, guerrilla style, hand to mouth. In a way, the collapse of his campaign had been the best thing for McCain, because when the campaign disintegrated, so did the crippling campaign dysfunction. McCain was at his best in the town hall meetings that were a staple of New Hampshire's quirky political culture. It was how he won the state in 2000, and ever since No Surrender, town halls in New Hampshire were the oxygen that sustained him. Week by week, day by day, he could feel himself picking up steam. For one thing, the crowds were getting bigger. He always took a mental count. For another, they were getting warmer. At a town hall up in North Haverhill in late November, the audience was practically hanging from the rafters. And when it was over, a stream of people came up and said, unprompted, "I'm voting for you." Equally heartening for McCain was this. No longer was he getting blistered by the anti-immigration forces. Oh, sure, he still had to defend his position on the issue. The hot-eyed ranting had ceased, however, and that was a good sign. McCain's advisors were glad to hear his rosy reports from the road, but contrary to what he might believe, they knew he couldn't win the state on town halls alone. Back in September, the campaign had scraped together just enough money to get him on the air in New Hampshire. McCain's advisors wanted to use the famous footage of him in Hanoi, filmed shortly after his capture. The pictures of him prone and in excruciating pain, his broken bones encased in slipshod dressing. McCain resisted, as he had throughout his career, the exploitation of his suffering for political gain, but Salter and Schmidt brought him around. "You don't have an option of not talking about who you are and what made you who you are," Schmidt said. "That decision got made the day you decided to run for President of the United States. Whether you like it or not, that's reality, and if you don't do it, we don't have a prayer." McCain reluctantly agreed, and the ad stirred up a lot of press attention. Several weeks later, at a debate, McCain snapped out a soundbite for the ages. "A few days ago, Senator Clinton tried to spend $1 million on the Woodstock Concert Museum," he said. "Now, my friends, I wasn't there. I'm sure it was a cultural and pharmaceutical event." Pause. "I was tied up at the time." The audience roared, and the campaign took the cue. The quip became part of another TV ad for New Hampshire. McCain had taken New Hampshire a bit for granted at the start, as he ran around trying to raise money to pay for that Bush machine his lieutenants were building. He'd made it easy for Romney to seize the top slot in the polls. The funny thing was, as events unfolded, this worked to McCain's advantage, with Romney writing him off for months. Now the former governor found himself under siege in Iowa, where Huckabee was coming on strong. More good news for McCain. It let him continue to fly under the radar. One day in late October, out of the blue, McCain told Charlie Black, "We got to get to 20% by December 1st in New Hampshire." Black had no idea where the number or target date had come from. Davis didn't know either. The goal struck them as arbitrary, but what the hell? If it helped McCain to have a tangible marker, fine. McCain had talked about the goal incessantly since then. 20%, 20%, 20%. Then one day, in late November, they all looked up, and there he was. Fox News put him at 21%, just 8 points behind Romney. Over Thanksgiving, McCain made another trip back to Iraq, accompanied again by Graham and also by Democratic Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut. While they were there, they met with General Petraeus and visited Jimmy McCain in Anbar Province. McCain and Lieberman had developed a close friendship through the years, and the war was a big part of it. Lieberman was inarguably the most hawkish Democrat in the Senate. He and McCain saw eye to eye on almost everything when it came to Iraq, But the bond was deeper than that. It was forged around the antipathy they both had for the bases of their parties, which was reciprocated in spades. Though Lieberman had been Al Gore's running mate in 2000 and was a fairly standard-issue Democrat on most social and economic issues, his foreign policy stances had made him an enemy of the left, and especially of the Netroots, which had successfully targeted him for defeat in the 2006 Connecticut Democratic primary. Lieberman now called himself an independent Democrat. McCain could relate to that. The day after returning from Iraq, McCain phoned Lieberman. "New Hampshire is going to be everything for me," he said, "and there's a lot of independents who are going to vote in the primary. I want to ask if you'd think about giving me your support. If you can't, I'll understand. You're in enough trouble with your party already, but I know it would help me out a lot." "Give me a couple of days to think it over," Lieberman replied. "It's a big step, but you know how I feel about you. We've been through a lot together, and particularly on the war." A former Democratic vice presidential nominee endorsing a Republican? It sure was a big step. Lieberman talked it over with his wife, a couple of staffers, a few friends back home. One of them said, "I think you're crazy." But McCain's campaign won't last long, so this will be a brief interlude. For Lieberman, deciding to support McCain would mean crossing another Rubicon. The calumny that would be hurled at him from the left, he knew, would be intense. On the other hand, not a single Democratic candidate had asked for Lieberman's endorsement, not even his fellow Connecticut Senator Chris Dodd. For all the distance between him and his party, Lieberman still found that level of ostracism surprising and painful, very painful. He believed that McCain had shown guts by putting his campaign on the line to stick with the surge, also that he'd be the best president in a dangerous world. "I don't agree with him on everything, but I agree with him on a lot of big things, and War and Peace is one," Lieberman thought. "Besides, the guy's my friend." Lieberman's endorsement came on December 15th in New Hampshire. For McCain, it capped a three-month run of favorable press, rising poll numbers, and the new storyline that McCain had created through the sheer force of his personality. Between Christmas and New Year's, a series of polls showed McCain ahead in New Hampshire for the first time since the early spring. McCain had gone from frontrunner to corpse to contender in less than a year. Everyone assumed he was flying high. The Mac was back. But the truth was, dangling over his head was a sword of Damocles, invisible to almost everyone, if no less menacing for that. The blade was in the form of a newspaper article that was threatening to drop any day. McCain thought it might kill more than his shot at the nomination. He thought it might destroy his career and his reputation, even though the woman at the heart of the story insisted that she'd never even been alone with him. Chapter 17. Slipping Nooses, Slaying Demons. Vicki Eisman was a small-town girl in Gucci Gulch. She came from rural Pennsylvania, born in the same burg as Jimmy Stewart, where she was a high school cheerleader. She arrived in Washington in 1990 with a degree in elementary education and everything she owned stuffed inside two plastic garbage bags. She landed a job as a receptionist at a lobbying shop called Alcalde & Fay. 8 years later, she became the youngest partner in the firm's history. On paper, she gave every appearance of being a familiar Washington archetype: ambitious, workaholic, politically connected, thin and blonde and pretty. But she was more a striver than a climber, more earnest than gimlet-eyed. Her clients were mid-level corporations, mostly telecommunications companies that no one had ever heard of. She didn't work the social circuit or want to be a public figure. She had no interest in appearing on Hardball. She seemed slightly wonderstruck by how far she'd come. When her college newspaper interviewed her in 2002, she talked about the great view of the nation's capital she had through her office windows and proudly listed the celebrities she had been lucky enough to meet: Melanie Griffith, Bo Derek, Britney Spears, and Rudy Giuliani. McCain was another bold-faced name with whom Eisman was acquainted by then. As the chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee in the late 90s, he held sway over regulations that affected companies she represented. Eisman supported McCain in his 2000 race and helped him raise money for it. In February 1999, she and the senator flew down to Miami and back together on the corporate jet of one of her clients to attend a fundraiser. The shared transport may have seemed like little more than a convenience to the lobbyist and the senator, but to McCain's advisers, it looked like trouble. With his wife 3,000 miles away, McCain was on his own for months at a time when he was in Washington. As a rule, his aides saw no need to police him and had no desire to play chaperone. The level of scrutiny accorded the private life of an ordinary senator was minimal anyway, but with McCain preparing for his first presidential bid, the glare of the spotlight was about to increase a thousandfold. Appearances mattered now more than ever, so when a rumor that McCain was having an affair with Eisman started flitting through Washington, his advisers blanched. Some thought it was true, some thought it was false, but they all feared that it could pry open a can of worms. The Eisman problem never reared its head publicly in 2000, and the qualms of McCain's team receded for years thereafter. But in the first half of 2007, just as McCain's new campaign was launching and faltering in the same breath, a reporter from U.S. News and World Report began pursuing a story that McCain and Eisman had been sexually involved. Eisman denied it. The McCainiacs pushed back hard. U.S. News ran an article on McCain and lobbyists, but mentioned neither the allegation nor Eisman. Now, in November 2007, the Eisman problem had returned with a vengeance. The New York Times was on the case, with four staffers assigned to the story. Eisman's colleagues at El Caldi told her that reporters had been calling and asking questions about her relationship with McCain. When one of them left a message for her, she refused to return the call. But she started to panic as she discovered the scope of the Times investigation. She called Rick Davis and told him about the unsettling intrusion into her life. "What is going on? Where is this coming from?" Eisman asked. "Is it Weaver?" Eisman had known Davis, a fellow lobbyist, longer than she had known McCain. She trusted Rick, unlike Weaver, whom she loathed. Back in 1999, after the Miami trip, Eisman and Weaver had clashed, with Weaver instructing her to steer clear of McCain, and they hadn't spoken since. Davis tried to soothe Eisman, who sounded desperate and a little unhinged, but he shared her surmise that his former rival was the culprit. Ever since his departure, Weaver had been carping to reporters about the McCain campaign. Davis blamed him for some nasty leaks in the wake of the near implosion. Within Team McCain, there was a strong suspicion that all roads in the Times inquiry led back to Weaver. But the sourcing behind the Eisman story was the least of the campaign's worries about it. The perception that McCain, the great reformer, was too close to the Capitol's influence peddlers had hurt him badly before. In 2000, the Bush campaign had skewered him mercilessly over that contradiction. Allegations of infidelity aside, the Times could do McCain damage on the hypocrisy front. The publication of the story might also incite more unwelcome snooping around in McCain's bedroom, which would be bad enough by itself, but potentially devastating in a party dominated by religious conservatives who didn't trust McCain to begin with. Already, as word had spread in media circles about what the Times was chasing, at least a half dozen new delvings into McCain's personal life had been undertaken by news organizations. At the same time, the campaign was coping with an incipient revival of the story about Cindy's alleged extramarital wanderings. McCain World had heard that there might be an incriminating surveillance videotape of her and another man. As November turned to December, the public picture of McCain's campaign was all about revival. But privately, his advisors were living in terror. Behind the scenes, no single issue was consuming more of the staff's time or psychic energy than the Eisman problem, and nothing was weighing more heavily on the candidate's mind. Outwardly, McCain was coming on strong in New Hampshire, but inside, he was coming undone. From early in the morning until late at night, he was distracted, tense, and gruff. Like Eisman, McCain was hearing that a wide range of his past and present associates was being contacted by the Times for the story. He dispatched friends with connections at the Gray Lady to try to penetrate its veil of mystery. "Where do you think we are on this?" McCain would ask. Umpteen times a day, he'd phone Davis, Salter, Black, or Schmidt, all of whom were dealing with the story in one way or another. "What's happening with the Times? Have we heard from them? What do they want? What do we have to do?" McCain's attitude about the likely outcome was dark. "They're out to get me, boy," he'd say. Or, "They're coming after us." Or, "They're going to fuck us." Finally, in early December, McCain decided he could take it no more. He thought the way the paper was handling the story was shoddy, its tactics bordering on harassment. He believed he had a relationship with Bill Keller, the executive editor of the Times. On a conference call with Davis and the rest of the campaign's top brass, McCain said, "Fuck it. I'll talk to Keller." McCain was astonished when, after reaching Keller, almost the first thing out of the editor's mouth was, "Is it true?" "I have never betrayed the public trust by doing anything like that," McCain said, and then got off the phone in a hurry. The next 2 weeks were a frenzy within the McCain camp, as the Times appeared to be moving toward publishing the story, which, apart from whatever seamy stuff it might contain, was apparently going to have a substantial look at McCain's efforts on behalf of corporate interests and their water carriers. Salter was spending 3/4 of each day doing nothing but diving into cardboard boxes, excavating ancient records, and pulling up documents in response to the Times reporter's detailed questions. On a parallel track, the campaign was preparing its defense strategy. Schmidt's well-honed and long-held view was that you couldn't go wrong in Republican politics by attacking the Times. To help with handling the media circus that was bound to ensue, McCain hired the Washington power lawyer Bob Bennett, who had served as Bill Clinton's personal attorney during the Paula Jones sexual harassment case. Meanwhile, Eisman hired a lawyer of her own, actually her second, and was in a bad way. She felt sick, wasn't eating, had lost a parlous amount of weight. Her paranoia was stratospheric. She was talking with Davis constantly, sharing with him her answers to the written list of questions the Times had provided at her request, a degree of coordination about which few were aware. At the top of her reply, Eisman wrote, "I am a private citizen. You are destroying my life." She again insisted that she never had a romantic relationship with the senator. The McCain campaign braced for the story to run the week before Christmas and sent Bennett to meet with the Times reporters. Then, on December 20th, the Drudge Report blared an item with the headline, "Media Fireworks! McCain Pleads with New York Times to Spike Story." The banner was a reference to the Keller call, but the tantalizing part of the post was elsewhere. The reporters hoped to break the story before the Christmas holiday, it said, but editor Keller expressed serious reservations about journalism ethics and issuing a damaging story so close to an election. The revelation that the Times was pursuing such an explosive line of inquiry caused the political world to gasp. The Romney campaign saw the item and worried that the piece would never be considered fit to print. For Romney, the publication of the story before New Hampshire would all but guarantee that he won the state. For McCain, the calculation was the converse. If the story ran, he was dead. The whole thing was excruciating for McCain. Fending off such personal attacks, true or false, felt like South Carolina all over again. "I do find the timing of this whole issue very interesting," McCain told the Associated Press on the day the Drudge item appeared, "and we're not going to stand for what happened to us in 2000. But Schmidt was certain that no act of defiance would be necessary at that point. "They don't have the story," he told McCain. "If we get to Christmas and they don't publish, we'll be fine. They're not going to put something out a few days before Iowa. It's just not going to happen." "I hope you're right," McCain replied, using one of his favorite expressions. What it meant was, "Don't bet on it." In the days before the New Hampshire primary on January 8th, the McCain campaign was suffused in an aura of nostalgia, the Straight Talk Express crisscrossing the snow-banked byways, with McCain in the back of the bus cracking wise, the hack pack huddled around him. McCain's town hall meetings were jammed, his wit and spontaneity on display. The Sunday before the primary, at an event in Salem, he was questioned by an audience member who objected to his support for Bush's tax cuts as fiscally irresponsible. "You're still in purgatory," the man said. "Thank you," replied McCain. "That's a step up from where I was last summer." McCain was openly, fanatically superstitious. In New Hampshire, he carried with him his lucky penny and lucky compass, and not only stayed in the same room in the same hotel as he did in 2000, but slept on the same side of the bed. And though such behavior might have struck some as obsessive-compulsive, it reflected his awareness of the role that blind luck had played in his revival. Mark McKinnon, the former media advisor to President Bush, who was now filling that role for McCain, observed that his current boss's winning required that he draw a political inside straight. In the last months of 2007, McCain had been dealt the first two cards in that hand, the apparent success of the Iraq surge and the reduction in the heat surrounding immigration. The result of the Iowa caucuses on January 3rd delivered him a third, Huckabee trounced Romney by 9 points, leaving McCain's only serious competition in New Hampshire reeling. The fourth card came courtesy of the Times, which made good on Schmidt's optimism and continued to hold back the Eisman story. And the fifth was slapped down in front of him by New Hampshire, where he won the primary by 5 points over Romney. Accepting his hard-earned victory, he told the crowd, "We are the makers of history, not its victims." McCain's luck at the table continued in the Michigan primary on January 15th, though it was less than evident at the time. In a state with the nation's highest unemployment rate and a manufacturing base hollowed out to the point of collapse, McCain had chosen candor over pander. "Those jobs aren't coming back," he declared, and paid the price at the polls, losing to Romney by 9 points. Yet McCain's long-run prospects were bolstered by the curious strategy pursued by Huckabee. With his fervent base of evangelical support, Huckabee stood as McCain's greatest threat in the next primary in South Carolina, which came 4 days after Michigan. But seduced by the notion that his appeals to economic populism would play well in Michigan, Huckabee and his team decided to devote several days and a pile of cash, precious resources of which he had little, to the state. Not only did Huckabee finish a distant third, but he also missed the chance to get a jump on McCain in South Carolina. With all eyes fixed on the Democrats, the Republican primary in the Palmetto State might as well have been occurring in Bora Bora for all the attention it received. Yet in the contemporary history of the GOP, no contest had been more reliable bellwether in determining who would eventually claim the Republican nomination. Since 1980, when Lee Atwater pushed his native state to the front of the presidential calendar, every winner of South Carolina had gone on to become the party's standard bearer. The McCains were nervous as they entered the sprint to primary day. The polls showed a tighter race than John had hoped it would be after his victory in New Hampshire, his lead over Huckabee in the low single digits. Cindy, still scarred by the memories of 2000, was uncomfortable every moment she spent on the ground, and her husband was only minimally less haunted. The possibility of another crushing loss in South Carolina, one that, in light of McCain's still threadbare financial circumstances, might effectively end his campaign, filled him with dread. In one crucial respect, however, the McCain of 2008 was a very different animal in South Carolina than the McCain of 2000. No longer the insurgent, no longer the rabble-rouser, he was the candidate of the establishment. His most loyal supporter, Lindsey Graham, was the state's senior senator and had done yeoman's work in corralling the endorsements of local elected officials early on and holding them in place during the dark days of 2007. At events across South Carolina in the days leading up to the vote, McCain stood arm in arm with those officials. He also basked in the glow of the support of the state's war veterans, some of whom had turned viciously against him in 2000. In almost no other way had McCain's campaign wound up resembling the Bush model, but he was grateful for these two exceptions. By primary night, no one had a clue as to what might happen. Romney had pulled most of his advertising to focus on Florida. That was good. Giuliani had failed to make the smart move and campaign along the affluent South Carolina coast, where there were scads of pro-choice voters, another boon to McCain. But when the polls closed, neither the networks nor the AP was prepared to project a winner. The early returns were screwy. The forecasting models were messed up. It was going to take a while. In the McCain's hotel suite, the tension was nearly unbearable. Always optimistic, Graham began doing his own analysis as the results from certain counties came in, predicting victory. But McCain didn't want to hear happy talk, even from Lindsey. "Don't say that," he snarled through gritted teeth. "You don't know that. Just shut up." Watching her husband pace around the room only made Cindy more anxious. "Is everything going to be okay?" she whispered to Davis, on the brink of tears. When word arrived after 8 o'clock that McCain had narrowly won, joy washed over Cindy, excitement over her husband, which was unusual. Normally for McCain, the relief of not losing was a more powerful emotion than the thrill of winning. But South Carolina was different. It was about vindication, about slaying demons, about putting paid to the past. McCain wasn't a drinker, but that night there was champagne. Yet the sweetness of South Carolina lasted only a few hours. McCain now faced what everyone expected would be the decisive primary of the season, Florida on January 29th. With Huckabee and Giuliani effectively finished, McCain was now finally going one-on-one against the rival he most disdained, Romney. If McCain prevailed in Florida, the nomination would be his. But if he lost, he would be heading into Super Tuesday mortally wounded, facing a candidate with tens of millions of dollars in personal wealth and little apparent reluctance to spend it. For the next 10 days, Romney campaigned like a conservative incarnation of Bill Clinton circa 1992. The economy, stupid, was his leitmotif. McCain talked of little besides Iraq, slamming Romney in a dishonest way for wanting to prematurely withdraw American troops. Earlier in the year, Romney had said he favored a private timetable for drawing down U.S. forces. But by the weekend before the vote, the polls remained razor-edge close. McCain and Romney were in a dead heat. Both men had long hoped that Charlie Crist would be their ticket to ride in the Sunshine State, but after all the hide-and-seek of 2007, Crist seemed to have decided to sit out the primary. "I'm not going to endorse anybody. Whoever's going to win is going to win," he told his advisor Lemieux on the Friday night before the Tuesday primary. The assurance quickly went out from Crist world to the Republican candidates. Charlie wasn't going to put his finger on the scale. The next day, however, Crist, outsailing with his fiancée, felt a pang of conscience. The governor's internal polling showed McCain slipping as Romney poured money into the state. Crist harkened back to the endorsement McCain had given him in 2006. "The guy's been really good to me," he thought. "I can't leave my friend behind." The following night, McCain was in St. Petersburg for the Pinellas County Lincoln Day dinner. Crist was slated to introduce him. Upstairs in McCain's suite at the Hilton where the event was being held, he asked John for a word alone and told him he would be endorsing him at the dinner downstairs in a few minutes. Crist's intervention propelled McCain to a 5-point win in Florida. The other Republican candidates and their advisors may have seen Charlie as a liar, a manipulator, and a no-account betrayer, but he was all right with John. To Crist's betrothed on primary night, McCain said, "God bless him." The next 3 weeks may have been the most glorious of McCain's political career. After Florida, much of his party fell into formation and smartly saluted him. Giuliani dropped out the next day and threw his backing to McCain. Arnold Schwarzenegger and Texas Governor Rick Perry climbed on board the day after that. McCain's face graced the cover of Time, above the tagline, "The Phoenix." And on February 5th, Super Tuesday, he racked up a clutch of big state wins, California, Illinois, New Jersey, New York, that put him within shouting distance of clinching the nomination. And yet there was still one enemy lurking that potentially had the power to hang McCain, the New York Times. The only questions were whether the Eisman story was in fact a noose around his neck and whether the paper would ever try to cinch it tight. All along, Schmidt had assumed that the piece would eventually run. The Times had invested too much time and effort in pursuing the matter to just let it drop. He was even more certain when, over the weekend of February 16th and 17th, the campaign heard that the New Republic was working on its own story about the internal deliberations at the Times over whether to publish the opus. There was no way the Times would let itself be scooped or embarrassed, Schmidt believed. The Eisman story was coming and coming soon, Schmidt told McCain. On February 20th, it came. Just hours before the piece went live on the web, Schmidt and Salter learned from the Times that it was being posted and was set to run in the paper the next day. McCain and his wife were campaigning in Toledo, Ohio. Schmidt and Salter had to get there fast. They raced to Reagan Airport in Washington, but their flight was delayed, so they grabbed a plane to Detroit instead, rented a car, and drove the 60 miles south. Along the way, they studied the story on their Blackberries. It ran to more than 3,000 words, the majority devoted to McCain's dealings with lobbyists. But the story also contended that, in 1999, some of McCain's aides and advisors had confronted him over an alleged affair with Eisman, and that McCain had acknowledged behaving inappropriately and pledged to keep his distance from her. It also recounted the Weaver-Eisman dust-up, with Weaver confirming by email and on the record that he had told Vicky to stay away from John. Weaver's chief concern, he said, was that Eisman had been bragging to others that she had professional sway over McCain, which threatened the senator's image as a reformer. It was nearly midnight when Schmidt and Salter finally rolled into Toledo. They found the McCains in their hotel suite. Cindy was distraught, had clearly been weeping. John was hardly in better shape. He said he was sure the campaign was over, that the story wasn't politically survivable, that he wouldn't be the nominee. "I don't know how we get through this," McCain said. Schmidt was having none of it. "This is going to be fine," he said. "This story is outrageous. Someone's going to get crushed on this, and it's going to be the New York Times." Emphatically, Schmidt laid out his plan for a counterattack. First thing the next morning, McCain would hold a press conference for the reporters traveling with him, Cindy by his side. "We're not going to put a clock on this," Schmidt said. "You're going to take every question. You'll deny the story, you'll express your unhappiness with the Times, and you'll do it in the proper tone." "You can't get up there looking pissed off," Schmidt said. "You have to be measured in the response." Although both McCains were furious at Weaver for having gone on the record in the story, Salter told McCain that he had to speak positively about his former wingman at the press conference. They needed to avoid giving Weaver an excuse to peddle anything further to the press. As for Eisman, they all agreed that McCain should call her a friend, which was what he said she was. The next morning, John and Cindy met the press. In a dark suit, blue shirt, and blue tie, McCain performed to Schmidt's precise specifications. He was calm. He was collected. He showed not the slightest flash of even the mildest annoyance. He answered many questions with a simple yes or no. He said that Weaver was a friend, and that the same was true of Eisman. Asked about the Times, he said, "This whole story is based on anonymous sources. I'm very disappointed in that." The press conference not only achieved its intended effect, but had some ancillary benefits. McCain never believed he would see the day when the raving right rallied around him in unison. But that was what was happening now. Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, Laura Ingraham, every one of them hated McCain. Yet within hours, they'd all hastened to his defense, because they hated the Times even more. "For the first time in history, John McCain won talk radio," Charlie Black drolly observed. The McCainiacs had feared that the Times story would open up the Pandora's box that was the senator's personal life. Although the Washington Post and Newsweek promptly ran their own similar anonymously sourced versions of the Eisman tale, the stories disappeared without a trace. The unequivocal denials of McCain and Eisman and the criticism of the Times for venturing into tabloid territory produced the same dynamic as had the paper's 2006 piece on the Clintons' marriage. The gray lady was forced to play defense, and McCain assumed the self-righteous pose of the aggrieved. Never again would the campaign face another serious press inquiry about the candidate's personal life. In defusing the Eisman story, McCain cleared the final remaining obstacle to his nomination. But the victory came at a cost. For 2 years, McCain's relationship with the media had been souring, but this turned things from sour to rancid, at least in his mind, where it counted. The campaign's dealings with the Times in particular would never be the same again either. There was no turning back, no way to restore even a modicum of trust with the most important print outlet in the country. Having dodged bullet after bullet, McCain clinched his party's nomination on March 4th by winning the primaries in Texas, Ohio, Rhode Island, and Vermont, and concluding one of the greatest political comebacks in modern American history. The next morning, he flew from Dallas to Washington to have lunch at the White House and claim his initial reward, the endorsement of one of the least popular Republicans in the country. The task of simultaneously embracing and maintaining sufficient distance from George W. Bush presented McCain with his first political challenge as the presumptive nominee. He handled it awkwardly, garbling his words as he told reporters in the Rose Garden, "I intend to have as much possible campaigning events together as is in keeping with the president's heavy schedule." The weeks between then and June, when the general election would unofficially begin, should have been a period of enormous opportunity for McCain. His approval rating, according to Gallup, was 67%, as high as it had ever been. In head-to-head polling matchups, he was running even with both Obama, by then the likely Democratic nominee, and Clinton. The two Democrats were pummeling each other, spending many tens of millions of dollars to do it, and the rancor in their party was growing every day. McCain, on the other hand, had an extended period to regroup after more than a year of chaos. He had won the nomination with no money, no organization, no well-defined message, and no sophisticated strategy. Now he had a chance to acquire all those things. The question was whether he would even try. On April 2nd, McCain arrived in Annapolis, Maryland, for one of the stops along his week-long Service to America biography tour. The idea was for him to travel to places of significance in his life story, reintroducing himself to voters and redefining his image. He would visit his high school in Alexandria, Virginia, military installations in Mississippi and Florida, where he'd been based, his political HQ in Arizona, and Annapolis, which he entered as a plebe in 1954. After leading the Pledge of Allegiance at a local diner, where scrapple-scarfing patrons huddled in booths beneath a sign that read, "Delicious pancakes, maple syrup, margarine," he arrived at a grander setting, the Navy football stadium. But no throng of midshipmen cum mechaniacs surrounded the candidate at the rostrum. In front of him instead were 60 folding chairs occupied by wizened dignitaries. Behind him were 35,000 seats, occupied by no one. McCain was cranky about the setting. "What is going on with this?" he asked his aides, but the speech was hardly better than the TV pictures. He sought to explain how a callow, shallow hellion had become a man of honor. At the academy, McCain said he was childish and prone to petty acts of insubordination. But then came the horrors he suffered in Vietnam, and the lessons Annapolis had sought to teach him took hold. "It changed my life forever," McCain said. "I had found my cause, citizenship in the greatest nation on earth." But his next sentence, "What is lost, in a word, is citizenship," sounded like a non sequitur, and that's because it was. The prompter was at fault. It had devoured a page of his script. Nevertheless, McCain's consiglieri professed themselves pleased with the tour. "It was open field running for us," McKinnon told a reporter. While the Democrats continued to attack each other and claw their way to the bottom, McCain was able to communicate a positive message and create a compelling narrative about the values he learned growing up that make him best qualified to be president. But for many Republicans, the biography tour began to instill pessimism about the party's nominee. McCain had failed to drive a message. He had failed to bore in on the weaknesses of Obama. He had failed to make news of any kind. The press coverage of the tour was perfunctory when not derisory. On The Daily Show, Jon Stewart dubbed it the Monsters of Nostalgia Tour, cracking that it had all the allure of an Atlantic City senior citizens outing without all the awkward sexual tension. Republicans worried, too, that McCain's organization was ramping up far too sluggishly. Although its leadership, Black, Davis, McKinnon, Salter, and Schmidt, was well-regarded, it seemed stretched too thin. The campaign had just 4 full-time finance staffers and no significant online fundraising presence. In March, it brought in a mere $4 million over the web and through direct mail. But the greatest Republican concern was about McCain himself, that in selecting a septuagenarian senator more comfortable in Washington than anywhere else, a dark-humored war hero with a distinctly pre-modern sensibility, a man who thought that being on Meet the Press was more important than going to church, actually that being on the show was going to church, the party had chosen Bob Dole all over again. The comparison seemed all too vivid and its implications all too dire on the night of June 3rd. As Obama celebrated having locked up his party's nomination, McCain delivered a televised speech that made Republican hearts sink across the land. In front of an unsightly green backdrop, he stammered through an uninspiring and uninspired text. His people knew it was a disaster from the moment he took the podium. They prayed the cable networks would cut away. The general election was now upon McCain. In his 3 unmolested months, he had accomplished next to nothing. His organization was still too small. He was still in the poorhouse. He still had no real message and no clear strategy. McCain wasn't happy about any of this, but panicked he was not. The guerrilla approach had won him the nomination. Why couldn't it work against Obama? Part 3. Chapter 18. Paris and Berlin. John McCain and Barack Obama entered the general election jointly holding out the hope of a different kind of fall campaign. For all of their intellectual, generational, and stylistic differences, McCain and Obama had much in common. Both candidates argued that Washington was broken, in need of root-and-branch reform, and ascribed its dysfunction to hyper-partisanship and the pernicious power of special interests. Both cast themselves as anti-politicians and post-ideological avatars. To gain their respective nominations, both relied on the support of centrist independents and even a handful of members of the other party. Neither had any inclination to turn the election into another bitterly polarized knife fight. Both boasted of being ready and able to lead a more civil and constructive conversation. There was one minor hitch with this rosy scenario, however. McCain and Obama didn't like each other. Not even a little bit. Their very first entanglement had ended in a fit of unusually public acrimony. It was in February 2006 when McCain asked Obama to collaborate with him on ethics reform. McCain always kept an eye peeled for young Turks who shared his propensity for bucking the system, and he didn't care if they happened to be Democrats. As a freshman congressman in the early 80s, McCain had been taken under the wing of Democrat Mo Udall, the legendary Arizona representative who was the liberal conscience of the House and a ringing voice for reform. The Udall precedent was on McCain's mind when he reached out to Russ Feingold, the novice Wisconsin Democrat who became his partner on campaign finance reform, and it was what drove McCain to approach Obama, the designated Democratic captain on ethics. Obama indicated an interest in working with McCain on a bipartisan initiative, but after attending a meeting of a McCain-led splinter group, Obama backed away, neglecting to call the Arizonan to let him know, instead sending a formal letter on February 2nd, announcing that he intended to push the Democratic version of ethics legislation, a letter that was released to the press before it reached McCain. McCain felt that he had extended his hand and Obama had slapped his face, and he directed Mark Salter to brush the whippersnapper back. Over his boss's signature, Salter fired off a letter to Obama that wound up in the hands of reporters post-haste, bristling with scorn and oozing sarcasm. "I'm embarrassed to admit that after all these years in politics, I failed to interpret your previous assurances as typical rhetorical gloss routinely used in politics to make self-interested partisan posturing appear more noble," it said. "I understand how important the opportunity to lead your party's effort to exploit this issue must seem to a freshman senator, and I hold no hard feelings over your earlier disingenuousness." Salter's chin music was the first time anyone in either party had tossed a high hard one at Obama, and it echoed through the Senate, where decorum made that kind of personal affront about as common as cut-off shorts at a confirmation hearing. The same day, Obama wrote back to McCain expressing cool puzzlement and ostensible solicitude. But when he was asked about the exchange by the press, Obama didn't hesitate to throw a brush back of his own. "The tone of McCain's letter, I think, was a little over the top," he said. "But John McCain's been an American hero and has served here in Washington for 20 years, so if he wants to get cranky once in a while, that's his prerogative." "Did you just call McCain cranky?" a reporter asked. "You got my quote the first time," Obama said tartly. Back in his office, Obama was blunter with his aides about his sentiments. "I'm not interested in being bitch-slapped by John McCain," he said. As far as McCain was concerned, the ethics kerfuffle was just the first in a series of incidents that revealed Obama's true colors. In 2007, when McCain was paying a brutal price politically for his work alongside Kennedy on immigration reform, Obama joined a bipartisan group of senators who'd agreed to band together and oppose amendments from the right and left that would scuttle the legislation. But then Obama promptly turned around and voted for several liberal provisions. A year later, he criticized McCain for coming out against a new GI Bill that would have guaranteed money for college to anyone who served 3 years in the military. "I can't believe that he believes it is too generous to our veterans," Obama tut-tutted. McCain didn't believe any such thing. He worried that the bill would create retention problems in the armed forces. Having his commitment to veterans questioned sent off McCain's first flare of genuine ire toward Obama. "I will not accept from Senator Obama, who did not feel it was his responsibility to serve our country in uniform, any lectures on my regard for those who did," McCain snapped. McCain never thought any of this would be of consequence in the presidential race. All along, he believed that he would be running against Clinton and relished the prospect. He liked Hillary, respected her, had become friendly with her in the Senate. They had traveled to the far reaches of the globe together and enjoyed each other's company. The vodka shots they'd shared once in Estonia had become the stuff of lore. His disappointment when she lost was palpable. By the start of the general election, McCain's view of Obama was firmly fixed and strikingly similar to the one that Hillary held. Obama was a lightweight, a line cutter, a go-along-to-get-alonger, who pretended to be a man of independence. and who bore none of the scars of political sacrifice that McCain wore as medals of honor. Honor was the core concept here, the soldier's highest virtue. McCain believed Obama lacked it, along with guts. McCain was fortified in his dim opinion by the people closest to him. Graham and Salter were always trashing Obama, and Cindy had been genuinely offended by Michelle's "proud of my country" remark. In the past, she rarely said a word about John's opponents, let alone an opponent's spouse, but as a mother of two sons in the service, she couldn't restrain herself. After she took her shot at Michelle on the stump, her husband gave her an approving thumbs up. The Obamas were a good deal less emotionally wound up in their opinions of the McCains. For all of Michelle's angst about the fallout from "proud of my country" and becoming a target of the right, she was taken aback when Cindy joined the fray. Michelle absorbed her counterpart's slam with private defiance. "Oh, so it's going to be like this. So this is how you want to play," she thought. Barack, meanwhile, regarded his past run-ins with McCain as faintly ridiculous. McCain had behaved like an arrogant jackass, happy if he could pat Obama on the head and have him follow his lead. But then all self-righteous and indignant if Barack took a different path. Whatever. Nothing Obama had seen had altered his conviction that the political environment was fertile for a Democratic victory. "If I lose the nomination to Hillary, I can hold my head up," he told his team on a conference call that spring. "But if I lose the general election to John McCain, I'll be run out of town on a rail." On June 4th, not long after the news broke that Clinton intended to concede, Obama received a congratulatory call from McCain. The two men pledged comity in the coming campaign and joked about how the pundits had written them both off a year earlier. But McCain also took the opportunity to press a proposal that he and Obama partake in 10 joint town hall meetings, one each week between June 12th and the Democratic convention. For McCain, the upside was obvious: a chance to go toe-to-toe with Obama in a format he loved and generate tons of free publicity to boot. For Obama, the payoff was less evident. In May, he'd said he would welcome debating McCain anywhere, anytime. Now Obama said he was open to the idea but made no commitments. The truth was, Obama had an array of more pressing concerns to deal with. After waging a nomination fight of unprecedented length and strain, he and his exhausted team had no time to rest their heads. In the span of a few weeks, they had to plan two vast and vastly complicated events: an ambitious trip abroad in July to help Obama buff up his foreign affairs bona fides, and the convention in August. At the same time, the Obamans had to devise a state-by-state electoral strategy for the fall and take the measure of their new adversary. Obama's lead pollster, Joe Benenson, quickly slammed together a presentation on the state of play. The good news, he reported, was that Obama was leading McCain by 49% to 44% among likely voters. The unexpected news was that the economy was now by far the most important issue, especially to undecideds. The neutral news was that neither Obama nor McCain was strong on that issue. The most surprising and most heartening news was that the perception of McCain as a maverick change agent was confined to the Beltway. In the rest of America, voters viewed him as Bush Redux. The implications for Team Obama's message were plain. Every breath they spent for the next 4 months would be devoted to shackling McCain to Bush on the economy. The Obamans had grand aspirations for remaking the electoral map. Pluff's plan was to target 17 battleground states, including some, Indiana, North Carolina, North Dakota, that hadn't voted Democratic in decades. That Pluff was thinking so boldly owed much to the breadth of Obama's appeal, but it had as much to do with the resources at his disposal. On June 19th, the campaign announced its decision to opt out of accepting public financing for the general election, making Obama the first candidate to do so since that system was implemented in the aftermath of Watergate. The decision was a reversal for Obama on two levels. He was a longtime champion of the public system and had signed a commitment on an interest group questionnaire in November 2007 to stay in it. The U-turn undercut the reformist image that Benenson's data showed was a vital advantage for Obama against McCain, but the unholy amount of money being sucked in by the campaign's web fundraising machine represented an even greater edge. McCain world learned about the decision around the same time it was becoming clear that Obama had no intention of doing the joint town halls. McCain wasn't surprised by either outcome, but they bolstered his sense of Obama as a phony. What bothered him more was the failure of the press to challenge Obama on his hypocrisy. If I'd done that, they'd kill me, he thought. McCain and his advisers had been astonished by how far in the tank the media had been for Obama during his race against Clinton. Now McCain, his relations with the press already strained, braced for a similar double standard. Steve Schmidt agreed with all of that, but thought it was slightly beside the point. The McCain campaign would be limited to the $84 million provided by the public financing system, although the Republican National Committee would supplement that with spending of its own. The Obamans were likely to raise 4 or 5 times as much. Making matters worse, the lengthy Democratic nomination fight meant that the Obama forces had operations in nearly every state, firing on all cylinders, whereas McCain world was sputtering along, forever on the verge of needing roadside assistance. In mid-June, after the Green backdrop debacle, Schmidt had a candid conversation with McCain about the state of the campaign. "How do you think things are going?" he asked his boss. "Not well," said McCain. "I think that's about right," Schmidt said. The structure of the campaign was still a mess. There was no political operation. Basic things weren't getting done. "We either need to fix this now," Schmidt said, "or not only will we lose, but we're in danger of going down as the worst-run presidential campaign in the history of American politics." For the first time in months, McCain seemed galvanized. He called a meeting of his senior advisors at his condo in Washington and elevated Schmidt to run the show alongside Davis. Almost instantly, McCain world was imbued with a new degree of discipline and order. Nicknamed Bullet by Bush Uber strategist Karl Rove and Sergeant Schmidt by McCain, the shaven-headed operative brought to his task 2 signal strengths, a relentless focus and zero tolerance for bullshit. He hired a top-flight political director. He instituted a regular message call at 8 o'clock every morning. He sought to limit McCain's cell phone use to keep him from terminal drift. He even took up the matter of housekeeping at the campaign's disheveled HQ. "This place looks like a fucking gypsy camp," Schmidt told the office manager over the July 4th weekend. "I want it painted and cleaned up by Monday." Schmidt also took the draconian step of curtailing his boss's access to the media. The old days of reporters indulging McCain's freewheeling disquisitions on everything from the caprices of his Senate colleagues to the temptations of Brazilian table dancers and not writing about them were long gone. Now the coverage was constant, glaring, and driven by the quest to trip him up. And so, in July, a barrier between McCain and the reporters covering him was installed on his jet. Press availabilities were cut back. Literally, figuratively, and symbolically, a curtain came down on the Straight Talk Express, just as one was rising on the Obamapalooza World Tour. It was, by every measure, an extraordinary spectacle, with a sprawling itinerary that would have posed real challenges to a sitting president and his team. 8 countries in 10 days, including 2 war zones, Kuwait, Afghanistan, and Iraq on the first leg, Jordan, Israel, Germany, France, and England on the second. And yet, the Obamans miraculously pulled it off without a hitch. The pictures beamed around the world were priceless. Obama visiting an army base and effortlessly sinking a 3-point shot in front of hundreds of cheering soldiers. Obama in a helicopter with General Petraeus, both in sunglasses and grinning like mad. The soaring speech in front of 200,000 at the Victory Column in Berlin. The interviews with each of the broadcast network anchors who had tagged along for the trip. The reaction of the McCain campaign was unambiguous. It went on the attack. It released an ad unveiling the campaign slogan, "Country First," with its insinuation that Obama put something else, that is, his ambition, above the nation. It aired another claiming that Obama, while he was in Germany, made time to go to the gym but canceled a visit with wounded troops. Seems the Pentagon wouldn't allow him to bring cameras. On the trail, McCain spat venom over an interview from abroad in which Obama said that, although the surge appeared to have been effective, he still opposed it. "It seems to me that Obama would rather lose a war in order to win a political campaign," McCain said. Schmidt doubted that any of it was working. "We're almost out of time," he said to Davis. "Obama is up by double digits now. He could be up 12 or 15 points heading into their convention. Bill Clinton's going to give a great speech. Hillary's going to give a great speech. Obama's definitely going to give a great speech. And even if he doesn't, the press will say he did. So now we're down 20 heading into our convention. On the first night, we have Cheney and Bush. After that, we could be down 25. If we don't figure out something immediately to arrest Obama's lead, we're done. On July 27th, the day after Obama returned stateside, Schmidt and a small group of McCain advisors met in a conference room at the Phoenix Ritz-Carlton to take up that task. "We're running against the biggest celebrity in the world," Schmidt said. Obama was flying at an altitude no politician had ever before attained. He was flying so high that there was no way to shoot him out of the sky or pull him down to earth. "Their only hope," Schmidt went on, "was to push Obama higher, push him from 20,000 to 40,000 feet above the so-called death line on Mount Everest, where there's not enough oxygen to breathe." "You said he's a celebrity," noted Fred Davis, McCain's lead ad man. "Well, let's turn that against him. Big celebrity? So's Britney Spears. So's Paris Hilton." The room exulted. Linking Obama with such famously insubstantial household names might shove him straight into the asphyxiation zone. Davis rushed off to produce some ads based on the concept. A version featuring Oprah was scuttled by Schmidt. "Don't politicize Oprah. She's more powerful than you can comprehend, like Obi-Wan Kenobi." A version including Ellen DeGeneres was nixed as well, but the incarnation with Britney and Paris was good to go. The ad, called Celeb, hit the air on July 30th. "He's the biggest celebrity in the world," a female voice intoned over soft-focus images of Spears, Hilton, and Obama in Berlin. "But is he ready to lead?" The ad's unveiling was accompanied by an email from Davis. "Only celebrities like Barack Obama go to the gym 3 times a day, demand Met RX chocolate, roasted peanut protein bars, and bottles of a hard-to-find organic brew, Black Forest Berry Honest Tea, and worry about the price of arugula." The message wasn't difficult to decode. Not only was Obama a celebrity, but he was precious, self-infatuated, effete, hoity-toity, a celebrelitist. Celeb quickly became ubiquitous on cable. It went viral on the web. "Trivial and trivializing," the talking head snorted. "Pathetic." And some liberals discerned a subtext in the ad that was more insidious. They saw the juxtaposition of Obama with the comely white women as an attempt to stir up fears of miscegenation. They pointed to a shot of the victory column and called it phallic. They cited an earlier McCain negative spot that showed Obama draining his three-pointer and found a racial angle there as well. That McCain World was trying to portray Obama as a blinged-up, camera-hogging NBA point guard, Allen Iverson with a Harvard Law degree. Obama seemed to see something, too. On the day that Celeb went up, he was campaigning in Missouri. At his first stop in Springfield, Obama said, "Nobody really thinks that Bush or McCain have a real answer for the challenges we face. So what they're going to try to do is make you scared of me. You know, he's not patriotic enough. He's got a funny name. You know, he doesn't look like all those other presidents on those dollar bills. You know, he's too risky." McCain was on a hair trigger over accusations or imputations of racism. He had warned his team to steer clear of anything that might open him up to that charge. He was emphatic that Reverend Wright was off limits. McCain World, however, feared that innocence wasn't a sufficient defense when it came to racial matters. John and Cindy had talked at length about the charges that had been leveled against the Clintons during the Democratic nomination fight. They believed that those accusations had been unfair, saw the Obama campaign's hand in the besmirching of Hillary and Bill's reputations, and had vowed not to let the same thing happen to them. So when Obama let loose with his "other presidents" comment, McCain and his lieutenants were gripped with a sickening sense of deja vu. "We got to call bullshit on this," Schmidt said. "Do whatever you have to do," McCain told Davis. "This is not right." The next morning, Davis put out a press release that minced no words. "Barack Obama has played the race card, and he played it from the bottom of the deck," Davis's statement said. "It's divisive, negative, shameful, and wrong." The Obamans had never been so directly challenged on playing the race card, except by Bill Clinton in South Carolina, when his head was in the process of exploding. The campaign's reaction was furious backpedaling. What Barack Obama was talking about was that he didn't get here after spending decades in Washington, Gibbs tepidly told the AP. He was referring to the fact that he didn't come into the race with the history of others, and is not about race. But, of course, it was. Obama himself had made the same point more explicitly 6 weeks earlier, when he said at a rally in Jacksonville, Florida, "We know what kind of campaign they're going to run. They're going to try and make you afraid of me. He's young and inexperienced, and he's got a funny name, and did I mention he's black?" But outside the context of the McCain negative ad assault, that remark had gone unnoticed. On his nightly call after the Davis broadside and the Gibbs retreat, Obama wasn't happy. The campaign had failed to defend him as well, as vigorously or as forthrightly as he thought it should have. Obama understood the strategic imperative of maintaining a post-racial métier, and he grasped the tactical wisdom of sometimes playing possum, of not letting race swallow the campaign, but he also believed that his campaign tended to be too gun-shy when the issue was forced upon them. "You guys are trying to pretend I'm not black," Obama said urgently. "I'm black." "You can't pretend this isn't an issue," he went on. "Of course it's an issue. You know McCain is playing the race card by accusing me of playing the race card. They're making sure that race is injected into this campaign. They're going to keep doing it in a lot of ways, and when they do it, we have to fight back." Axelrod's head wasn't buried in the sand with respect to Obama's pigmentation or its political implications. He had no doubt that the McCain campaign would employ an assortment of race-freighted messages against Obama. In Celeb, Axelrod saw a bid to paint Obama as a figure undeserving of his success, the affirmative action nominee. From his experience with other African-American candidates, he suspected that coming next would be volleys on a pair of issues that pushed racial hot buttons, crime and taxes. But the Obamans were preparing for far more nefarious assailments than that, if not directly from McCain world, then from shadowy independent groups on the right. The degree of Chicago's readiness was a well-kept secret. There was no sense in admitting publicly how concerned they were about Obama's vulnerabilities surrounding his race and background, but the worries were considerable, especially about the consistent thread they picked up from voters that wove together the false rumors about Obama being a Muslim with the charge that he was insufficiently patriotic. While the cash-poor McCain campaign was coming up with negative ads on the fly, scribbling scripts in effect on the backs of napkins, airing the spots without ever testing them, the well-heeled Obamans were running a stealthy high-tech lab to discover which attacks were most dangerous and to develop responses. Dozens of Obama-funded faux negative ads against Obama were produced and tested, about right, heirs, Muslimism, the flag pin, the works, and some were devastatingly effective. Obama had begun inoculating himself against the charges that his brain trust presumed were on the horizon, but some efforts he resisted as too ham-handed. At one point, he and his ad team were preparing to shoot a spot designed to deal with Muslimism and patriotism in one throw. "If I have the privilege of taking the oath of office, I would do so with my hand on the Bible and pride in my heart," the script read. Obama began to recite it, then stopped and grimaced. "Guys, I can't do this," he said. "There are limits." Yet despite all the study and safeguarding, Obama and his campaign were caught off guard and knocked off balance by Celeb and its aftermath. Through the entire nomination fight, Clinton had never found a consistent negative frame in which to put her opponent. Now, almost by happenstance, McCain world had conjured one. And the whole of the rightward realm, from the Republican National Committee to the flying monkeys of conservative talk radio, was pounding away at Obama in a concerted fashion, just as it had done to Dukakis, Gore, and Kerry. The frame was dead simple. McCain equals country first. Obama equals Obama first. After weeks of bombardment over the airwaves, Obama's negative ratings were inching upward, just as Hillary and Bill had predicted. Now he faced a trio of challenges in rapid succession, selecting his running mate, making peace with the Clintons, and delivering a dynamite convention speech. The last of these might have been a gimme. This was Obama, after all, but the first two would require the savvy of a Metternich and the patience of a saint. And there was no room for error. On August 1st, the Gallup tracking poll made Obama versus McCain a dead heat. Chapter 19. The Mile High Club. The senator arrived in Minneapolis in disguise. Having shed his uniform of suit and tie, wearing a baseball cap pulled down low on his forehead and a pair of aviator shades. The Obama people told him they were worried he'd be recognized, so he was traveling incognito. When he climbed off the private jet from Washington on August 6th, a young woman hustled him into a waiting car with tinted windows. As they set off for the Graves 601 Hotel, the site of the secret meeting, the senator couldn't stop talking. "This is the first time in decades," he said to his escort, "that I've been on a job interview." Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. didn't want to be vice president, at least not at the start. He liked to trot out an old chestnut for his aides. A woman has two sons. One goes off to sea, the other becomes vice president. Neither is heard from again. No, what Biden wanted was to be Secretary of State. That was a real job. But then Obama began pushing the VP thing, and Biden's competitive juices started flowing, especially when he thought about the other names supposedly on the shortlist. Tim Kaine? Evan Bayh? Kathleen Sebelius? Nothing against them, Biden thought, but if that's the group, I'm the guy. It was that kind of cogitating that had gotten Biden into the 2008 race in the first place, that and a hunger for redemption. 20 years had passed since his first White House bid ended in ignominy, when he was caught lifting lines from a British politician's speech. He'd survived 2 brain aneurysms and turned himself from a Gabby showboat into the still showboaty chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and one of the party's leading voices on judicial matters, too. He'd abstained from running in 2004, although the political circumstances would have been better for him. This time, he was ready. His wife Jill was ready. At 64, he saw it as his last chance. Biden knew he was a long shot, but he also knew he was more qualified than his opponents. In 1988, he had believed he could do the job of getting elected. Looking at 2008, he believed he was up to the task of being president. His campaign ended, in effect, on the day it started, cut down in its tracks by his mortal enemy, his own mouth. It was that first morning, January 31, 2007, when Biden was quoted in the New York Observer calling Obama the first mainstream African-American who is articulate and bright and clean and a nice-looking guy. Biden spent the day of his announcement apologizing to Obama, among others, for having tiptoed into a racial minefield in concrete shoes. The gaffe resurrected every caricature of Biden as a victim of terminal logorrhea and instantly crippled his fundraising. He snared 1% of the vote in Iowa, finished 5th, and dropped out that same night. A week later, Biden's inner circle assembled around the kitchen table at his home in Greenville, Delaware, just outside Wilmington. They spent 5 hours having lunch, gazing out the big kitchen windows at the frigid lake beside the house, speculating and scheming about what might come next for Joe. Biden had acquitted himself with honor after his disastrous opening salvo. His debate performances were top-notch, funny, smart, and even disciplined. Somehow, despite his drubbing,